listeners and friends, you are listening to a reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls for Thursday, June 10th. I'm your reader, Maddie Ryan. Why don't we go ahead and take a look around the Courier today? Right off the bat, the weather forecast for today is partly sunny with a high of 93 and a low of 72, so it'll be a hot one today, everyone. The first headline reads, Strip Mall Eyed at Kimball Ridge. Second story of the day, Doughy Joe's Pizza is back. Next story, Sponsor Abandons Keystone Pipeline. And the last article on the front page of the Courier today reads, Vaccine Demand Plunges in Iowa. We will roll right in to that first story, Strip Mall Eyed at Kimball Ridge. Old Schultz Hospital would be demolished. This is filed by Jeff Reinitz of the Courier. Dateline, Waterloo. Plans are in the works to tear down the Kimball Ridge Center to make way for a new commercial development. The property at 2101 Kimball Avenue and the adjacent address on Ridgeway Avenue have been mostly vacant for years. On Tuesday, the Waterloo Planning, Programming, and Zoning Commission approved a request to rezone the land to allow for a shopping center. The rezoning request will move the City Council for further approval, pending a study to see what the project would mean for traffic in the area. We've been working on this project for a couple of years and have taken a couple of shots at trying to make this project work. I think I've made some good traction along these lines, said Jeff Stickfort, a contractor working with C10 Investments, LLC, which made the rezoning request. We're pretty excited, he said. I think it's great to have development in that area because it has sat for a while, and I think it will be a betterment for the area, said Commission member Sue Flynn. Formerly, Schultz Hospital, the building recently had been the location of Ridgeway Place as assisted living and a rehabilitation and fitness center, all of which have moved to new locations. Last year, the site housed a temporary COVID-19 testing facility. The plan calls for rezoning about 6 acres and moving the main structure. The Mercy One Medical Arts Building northwest of the site would remain, according to the plan. The site would be divided into 3 slots and 5 buildings would be built following the demolition. Jim Lind, who operates a gas station and auto repair garage across the street, asked about any effect the development would have on stormwater drainage in the area during Tuesday's commission meeting. Documents show the site currently has a private storm drain, and the zoning recommendation includes that a drainage plan would be required for any development on the site. Lind also asked if the property would be eligible for tax increasement financing incentives. I am very supportive of having some neighbors across the street again like we had for many years, and we certainly want to see that again. We just worry about our tax dollars, Lind said. City officials said the location currently isn't in a TIF district, but that existing districts could be expanded to include the land. Stickfort said a tunnel under Ridgeway Avenue that leads to the former hospital property would be filled as a part of the project. The primary reason for this is if the tunnel were to collapse, we would end up with an 8-foot hole in the street, he said. He said part of the operation would be done underground without disturbing the surface. Rolling on over to our next story, the headline reads, Doughy Joe's Pizza is back. Downtown Waterloo restaurant reopens under new ownership. This was filed by Kristen Guess of the Courier. Dateline, Waterloo. The time has come. Doughy Joe's Pizza joint is reopening its doors to the public today. Owners Andrew Howe and Allison Blake have taken the leap from managing the Cedar Falls Doughy Joe's to owning their own store. It's pretty stressful now, but I think it will be fun, Howe said. The popular restaurant has returned to familiar location at 300 West 4th Street in downtown Waterloo. The location is Doughy Joe's original home. Doughy Joe's Cedar Fall location is at 126 Brandylin Boulevard, closed after a decline in June 2020. The building was torn down to make way for a new DePaco Community Credit Union branch. The Downtown Waterloo restaurant closed in 2014 after 13 years on 4th Street, and the building has been vacant. Repainted walls, new floors and seating, and an expanded kitchen enclosure, they are ready to take on the menu from the Cedar Falls location, which has had more options than the former downtown locations. There is multi-level seating and a party room as well. Blake said they are fortunate to have several employees return from the Cedar Falls location. "That's been very, very helpful," she said. "Some of them were students and just went home for a while during the pandemic and now have returned." Like many other Cedar Valley restaurants, they are struggling to find workers. They've hired 25 employees so far, but could use another 10 staff members. When asked about how many hours per week they've been preparing for the opening, Howe said, "All of them." Howe managed the Cedar Falls Doughy Joe's for owner-founder Chuck Landau. He previously managed Landau's Waterloo Brown Bottle restaurant for 6 years. Landau made Howe an offer after the Cedar Falls real estate deal was completed in July 2020. "My wife and I wanted to downsize. We had too much going on. I offered my manager, Andrew, who has been with me for 12 years, a licensing agreement. He's capable. It's not a franchise. It's a license to operate the business. It's fully his restaurant, and I have nothing to do with it," Landau told the Courier last year. Joey Doe's will be open Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays from 11 to 9 p.m. and Fridays and Saturdays from 11 to 10 p.m. The restaurant will be closed on Mondays. I don't know about anyone else, but all that article has done is make me really want a slice of pizza for today. Okay, jumping from pizza to gas pipelines, the story headline reads, "Sponsor abandons Keystone Pipeline. President canceled permit for project." This was filed by Matthew Brown of the Associated Press. Dateline reads, Billings, Montana. The sponsor of Keystone XL crude oil pipeline pulled the plug on the contentious project Wednesday after Canadian officials failed to persuade President Joe Biden to reverse his cancellations of its permit on the day he took office. Calgary-based TC Energy said it would work with the government agencies to ensure a safe termination of and exit from the partly built line, which was to transport crude from the oil sand fields in north and western Canada to Steel City, Nebraska. Construction on the 12,000-mile pipeline began last year when former President Donald Trump reversed the long-delayed project after it had stalled under the Obama administration. It would have moved up to 30 million gallons of crude daily, connecting in Nebraska to other pipelines that fed oil refineries on the U.S. Gulf Coast. Biden canceled the pipeline's border crossing permit in January over longstanding concerns that burning oil sand crude could make climate change worse and harder to reverse. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had objected to the move, rising tensions between the U.S. and Canada. Officials in Alberta, where the line originated, expressed frustration in recent weeks that Trudeau wasn't pushing Biden harder to reinstate the pipeline's permit. Alberta invested more than $1 billion in the project last year, kickstarting construction that had stalled amid determined opposition to the line from environmentalists and Native American tribes along this route. Alberta officials said Wednesday they reached an agreement with TC Energy, formerly known as TransCanada, to exit that partnership. The company and province plan to try to recoup the government's investment, although neither offered any immediate details on how that would happen. We remain disappointed and frustrated with the circumstances surrounding the Keystone XL project, including the cancellation of the presidential permit for the pipeline's border crossing, Alberta Premier Jason Kenney said in a statement. The province had hoped the pipeline would spur increased development in the oil sands, being tens of billions of dollars in royalties over decades. Climate change activists viewed the expansion of oil sands development as an environmental disaster that could speed up global warming as the fuel is burned. That turned Keystone into a flashpoint in the climate debate, and it became the focus of rallies and protests in Washington, D.C. and other cities. Environmentalists who had fought the project since it was first announced in 2008 said its cancellation marks a landmark moment in the effort to curb the use of fossil fuels. Good riddance to Keystone XL, said Jared Margolis, with the Center of Biological Diversity, one of the many environmental groups that sued to stop it. On Montana's Fork Belknap Reservation, Tribal President Andy Work Jr. described the end of Keystone as a relief to Native Americans who stood against it out of concern that the line would break, could full the Missouri River and other waterways. Attorneys general from 21 states had sued to overturn Biden's cancellation of the pipeline, which would have created thousands of construction jobs. Republicans in Congress have made the cancellation a frequent talking point in their criticism of the administration, and even some moderate Senate Democrats, including Montana's John Tester and West Virginia's Joe Manchin, had urged Biden to reconsider. Tester said in a statement Wednesday that he was disappointed in the project's demise but made no mention of Biden. Wyoming Senator John Barrasso, the top Republican on Senate Energy Committee, was more direct. President Biden killed the Keystone XL pipeline and with it thousands of good-paying American jobs. A White House spokesperson did not immediately respond to a request for comment on TC Energy's announcement. In his January 20 cancellation order, Biden said allowing the line to proceed would not be consistent with my administration's economic and climate improvements. TC Energy said in canceling the pipeline, and the company is focused on meeting evolving energy demands as the world transitions to different power sources. It said it has $7 billion in other projects under development. Keystone XL price tag had ballooned as the project languished, increasing from $5.4 billion to $9 billion. Meanwhile, oil prices fell significantly from more than $100 a barrel in 2008 to under $70 in recent months, slowing development of Canada's oil sands and threatening to eat into any profits from moving the fuel to refineries. All right, on to our last article that is featured on the front page. The headline reads, "Vaccine Demand Plunges in Iowa. State's National Rank for Vaccination Slips." Filed by David Pitt of the Associated Press. Dateline Des Moines. Demand for vaccine in Iowa has dropped dramatically in recent weeks, with the state ordering fewer doses each week and sliding downward in its national ranking for fully vaccinated people. Iowa ordered 2,450 doses for this week, with 16 out of Iowa's 99 counties requesting doses, Iowa Department of Public Health spokesperson Sarah Ekstrin said. Last week, the state ordered 5,210 doses, and the week before, 7,850 doses. State public health officials have decided to no longer automatically allocate doses to every county each week, and instead will survey the counties and determine if the need for each week and order only the amount, Eckerd said. State data shows a significant decline in the number of doses administered per day since mid-April, when an average of nearly 31,000 doses a day were being administered in Iowa. That has fallen to an average of less than 7,000 doses a day in the past week. Iowa has been slipping in the ranking among states for the percentage of the population fully vaccinated. Iowa ranks 21st in the nation with 1.4 million people, or 4.49% fully vaccinated, according to the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. 2 weeks ago, Iowa was 17th. The state has been dealing with significant vaccine resistance in recent weeks, but Republican Governor Kim Reynolds has said she has no plans to implement an initiative program to encourage vaccinations, as some states have done, to boost interest. She said vaccine is available for anyone who wants it. Some states have offered prizes such as lottery tickets as an enticement. In April, Reynolds set a goal of reaching 75% of Iowan adults vaccinated by the end of June. As of Tuesday, 52.9% of Iowans age 18 and older have been fully vaccinated, and 62.3% have had at least one dose. All right, listeners, we're going to turn over to some news from the Cedar Valley. Our first article headline from the Cedar Valley reads, CF students in rocketry challenge. 8-member STARS team among 100 U.S. qualifiers nationally. This was filed by Andrew Wind of The Courier. Dateline, Cedar Falls. After a year's delay, a Cedar Falls high school team will launch its rocket Saturday as part of a national competition. The 8-member Science, Technology, and Rocketry Students Club found out this spring that its qualifying flight put the group among 100 American Rocketry Challenge finalists. Painted to look like an ear of corn, the 2.5-foot tall by 2.5-inch diameter rocket weighing 1.5 pounds had reached 800 feet within 4 to 43 seconds to qualify for the national finals. It also carried a raw egg that is deployed that needed to survive the flight. The Cedar Falls team, more commonly known as STARS, was among 615 teams with more than 5,000 students competing for finalist slots in the contest, which wasn't held last year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. It is sponsored by the Aerospace Industries Association. "We expected to qualify," said junior Harrison Redfin. "We built this rocket over a year ago. We had time to fine-tune it." The team is coached by teacher Zeb Nicholson and has advanced to this and other competitions during previous years with different groups of students. And earlier this year, for the first time, it participated in another competition, Rockets for Schools. Members built a different rocket for that, which stands about 93 inches tall and is 5.5 inches in diameter and weighs 12 pounds and is painted with the image of a hydra, the mythical creature with many heads, which could regenerate if chopped off, is symbolic of the rocket carried tapeworms that can grow if cut off in half. Junior Jefferson Roberts said the big goal of that competition was to see how flight impacted the tapeworms, stem cells. Results of that event qualify the team for the NASA student launch, which will take place during next school year. NASA launch qualification is also an outcome Saturday for teams that do well enough. Typically, everyone gathers in Washington, D.C. for the American Rocketry Challenge Finals. However, this year, Roberts said, there's 11 launch sites across the country to keep groups smaller in response to continuing pandemic concerns. The team's launch will be at Richards Bong State Park near Bright, Wisconsin. The STARS rocket will need to reach 775 feet in 93 to 42 seconds for one launch and 825 feet in 41 to 44 seconds for the other launch on Saturday. Robert said that will require making adjustments to its mass. Along with the egg, the rocket contains a plastic container created with a 3D printer that the team fills with nuts and bolts. Based on past flights, the group has data on the weight of the rocket in reaching certain altitudes in a particular amount of time. Teams get a point for every foot they're off from the goal height and 4 points for every second they're off. They're trying to get as few points as possible. The top 10 teams receive prize money totaling $100,000, and those finishing in the top 25 qualify for the NASA launch. STARS has completed 6 or 7 test flights with the rockets being used Saturday, said Redfin. But the weather at the 11 test sites will be a bigger factor than when they are all in the same location. A lot of it boils down to luck, he said. When everyone competes in D.C., everyone has the same disadvantage, Robert said, when it comes to factors like wind, rain, and humidity. Since the Cedar Falls team already qualified for the NASA event in earlier competition, that has set a course for what it will do after Saturday's event, no matter the outcome. We're just excited to see what this year will hold, Roberts added. Next story from the Cedar Valley area. Headline reads, Waverly puts school housing development on hold. Myers sworn into Ward 2 council seat. This was filed by Amy Rivers of the Courier. Dateline, Waverly. A plan to create affordable housing on the city-owned former Washington Irving School lot has been shelved. City staff said there is no consensus for the project. A lack of interest from developers and the current high cost of materials also contributed to the decision. William Wagner, Waverly's Director of Community and Economic Development, told the City Council on Monday the city has rescinded a request for proposals to build townhomes, row houses, or other types of multifamily housing on the triangular lot at 213 6th Street Southwest. The council already had approved a request for proposals as well as a public hearing set to happen Monday night to rezone the site from 1 and 2 family residentials, or R2, to multiple family residential, or R3. We felt there wasn't a real good consensus, Wagner said, noting for state incentives, evidence of community support was needed. We just think that we're pushing it too quickly, and we weren't getting much interest when we reached out to people, Wagner said. Staff would try again next year when he hopes the price of things like sheets of plywood, now around $100 compared to $20 in the recent past, would come down, spurring more interest from developers. Several council members expressed relief the project won't be moving forward. I heard a lot of neighbors say we want single-family homes and on the lot, not multifamily units, said the at-large member Matthew Schneider. Schneider said he was afraid developers would build them and turn them, though at-large member Ann Wraith countered there wasn't proof of that. I think it depends on what you design, and I agree the neighbors need to be listened to, she said. Hopefully we can come to a consensus and do it when materials are less expensive. Also Monday, the winner of recent special election was sworn in at the first in-person council meeting since the pandemic suspended live meetings. Julie Myers was sworn in as Ward 2 council member by City Administrator James Broner to applause. I'd like to officially welcome you to municipal government and serving your community, Mayor Adam Hoffman said. Myers, a Berman Avenue business owner and former critical care nurse, handily won the three-way contest with challengers John Baber and Mike Harrington in a June 1 special election to fill the remainder of Chris Garcer's team, which is up in January 2024. Glasser resigned May 31st after taking a job in Des Moines area. Myers was endorsed by Glasser and won with 61% of the vote to avoid a runoff. Next story from the Cedar Valley, the headline reads, Union School District Investigating Cyber Attack Data Hack. This was filed by Andrew Wynn of The Courier. The dateline reads LaPorte City. Union Community School is responding to an incident where someone gained unauthorized access to its electronic data during a cyber attack this spring. We investigated and notified any individuals that we needed to, Superintendent Travis Fleschner said in response to questions from The Courier. While the school district has already worked through issues related to the data breach, he noted in a written statement that some documents are still being reviewed to determine if they were accessed. In early April, the Union Community School District became aware of a cybersecurity incident that temporarily disrupted our computer system and servers, Fleischer said in a statement. After discovering the incident, we quickly took steps to secure our system and restore operations. We immediately initiated an investigation to determine the potential scope of the incident, and third-party forensic experts were engaged to assist in our investigation and recommendation efforts. We also notified federal law enforcement. It was determined that the unauthorized individual acquired certain information from our systems, he said. As a result, the district began notifying affected people. Out of an abundance of caution, to provide additional guidance on how they can help to protect their information. But as the ongoing investigation continued, officials became aware of additional documents that may have been accessed by an unauthorized individual. Those documents are currently under review, and the district is committed to providing additional information to the community as quickly as possible, Fleischer said. We regret any concern this incident may cause our community, and we are continuing to enhance our cybersecurity policies, procedures, and protocols to attempt to minimize the likelihood of this occurrence again, he added. Union School policy on care, maintenance, and disposal of records state that personal information of students or employees maintained electronically includes a source backup file. Students' permanent records are preserved indefinitely, with employment applications are kept for 2 years and payroll records for three. Non-payroll personnel records are maintained for 10 years after an employee leaves the district. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, June 10th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, why don't we turn to today's obituaries. From Morristown, Marion Frances Ottens. Marion Frances Ottens, 82, of Morristown, Tennessee, passed away on Saturday, June 6, 2021, at the home of her son in Morristown, Tennessee. Funeral services will be 2 p.m. Friday, June 11, 2021, at St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Denver, Iowa, with visitation from 12 noon until the time of the service at the church. There will be a graveside service held at 1 p.m. Saturday, June 12, 2021, at Grove Hill Cemetery in Morrison, Illinois. The Bosema Rinks Funeral Home, Morrison, Illinois, is in charge of arrangements. A memorial has been established to the Parkinson's Foundation. Marion was born September 17, 1938, in Denver, Iowa, to John William and Roseanne DeVries. Marion was educated in Denver, Iowa, grade school, and was a graduate of Denver High School. She then graduated with a nursing degree from Allen College in Waterloo, Iowa. She married Laverne Ottens on November 10, 1962. He died in March of 1983. Marion later married Peter Ferberg, and he died on June of 2018. She was a retired registered nurse from Alexson Brothers Medical Center in Elk Grove Village, Illinois. Marion was a former member of the Prince of Peace Lutheran Church in Hoffman Easters, Illinois, and Bethany Lutheran Church in Crystal Lake, Illinois. She was an avid bridge player. Georgia Mary DeMuth, 63, of Northcrest Specialty Care, formerly of Jessup and Gerberville, died Tuesday, June 8th at University Point Allen Hospital Hospice. She was born May 14th, 1958, in Waterloo, the daughter of George and Dorothy DeMuth. Georgia attended River Hills School and did different tasks to Goodwill, North Star Community Services, and Norwell Post. She shared an assisted living residence with her friends Lulu, Connie, Donna, and Kayla. She participated in local Special Olympics and many sports for multiple years, with her greatest accomplishment participating in the Special Olympics World Games held at Yale University in 1995. She was always riding her bike, visiting residents in Gerbertville, and to attend sporting events. Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m., Saturday, June 12th, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, with burial in St. Mary's Cemetery, both in Gerbertville. Public visitation from 4 to 7, Friday, at Haggerty Wyckoff Graup Funeral Service on South Street in Waterloo. Visitation also 1 hour prior to services, Saturday, at the church. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Special Olympics, North Star Community Services, or River Hills. Marlis J. McDonald from Washburn. Marlis J. McDonald, 80, of Washburn, died Tuesday, June 8, 2021, at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital. She was born January 26, 1941, in Waterloo, the daughter of Wayne and Marjorie Knipp Falk. She was a 1958 graduate of Orange High School. She married Paul G. McDonald on May 20th, 1961, in Waterloo. She worked for Waterloo Schools, retiring after 36 years. Survived by her husband Paul, two daughters, Diane and Jan, son Mark, eight grandchildren, four great-grandchildren, and three brothers. Memorial services will be held 11 a.m. Friday, June 11th, 2021, at Kieran's Funeral Service, Kimball Chapel. Family will receive friends 1 hour before the service. A video of the service will be posted to the funeral home website. Memorials may be directed to St. Paul's Presbyterian Church, Washburn, or Moose Lodge Chapter 328, Washburn. Ramona Ruth O'Connor, Waterloo. Ramona Ruth O'Connor, 99, of Waterloo, died May 19th, 2020. A memorial mass will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday at St. Edward's Catholic Church, with interment in Mount Olivet Cemetery. Haggerty Wyckoff Graup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway is in charge of arrangements. That concludes the obituaries for today. Why don't we take a peek at the opinions and editorials for today? Today's first editorial headline reads, "Respect the Wisdom of Our Elders." This editorial originally appeared in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. What do Queen Elizabeth, 95, Janet Yellen, 74, our president, 78, and the Pope, who's 84, have in common? How about Mike DeWine, 74, Jerry Brown, who's 83, and Lamar Alexander, who is 80? They are all public men and women who are making major contributions in what once would have been thought their dotage. They are not only hanging on or still going strong, but arguably doing their best work. The late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died at 87, but was working full tilt, fully employing her little gray cells up until almost the very end. George Wills is 80 and better than ever. Mark Shields, 84, is much missed as a weekly news analyst. He could say more off the cuff than most commentators could after extended study and participation. Why? Accumulated memory. He's seen it all in politics. All this is not only cheering news for geezers themselves, but it suggests that a special contribution can be made by the veterans among us. A geezer has often honed his or her knowledge, his or her passions, and his or her anxieties and insecurities. What historian John Meacham said about Biden is that this is a man who has known tragedy and who thought his political career was over. He no longer sweats the small stuff. When Jerry Brown returned to the governor's mansion in California after 28 years, he said he was the largest active public figure in the Western Hemisphere next to Fidel Castro. It was a joke, but he was not far off. He was 73 at the time and got into politics in his 20s. He was 73 at the time and got into politics when he was 20. He is 83 now and left office just 2 years ago. Unlike Castro, Brown learned from his youthful errors and had grown relaxed and wise. He didn't need a pollster or handler to tell him what to say in press conferences or how to cut his hair. And he did a fine job on his second tour of duty. Europeans traditionally have had more respect for their elders of their culture and politics and were more willing to invest them with power. Think Konrad Attur in post-World War II Germany. He came to power as chancellor at 73 and held office for almost 17 years. Charles de Gaulle was president of France from 1959 to 1969. He was 69 when he took office and was viewed as an old man. He had long been a national legend after leading the Free French in the war. His greatest chapter was to come. Churchill was returned to No. 10 Downing Street at the age of 77. He was not in great shape physically, but Churchill at 50% was worth most men at 500%. You don't have to be able to play touch football to lead. You need to know something. Barack Obama played basketball as president, which Joe Biden couldn't do. But Biden understands the Republicans and the Hill and the shelf life of presidency far better than Obama did. And he can talk to a cop or factory worker. What gave him those gifts? Simply his years. Brown was also the son of a governor. Someone asked him once, "What did you learn from your father?" "I learned how to make the moves," he said. There is no tutor like a father with experience, and no teacher life like experience. We know this is so in the arts. Look at Willie Nelson, aged 88, or Bob Dylan, 80. Both are still recording. And is there a better, more prolific film director than Clint Eastwood? At 91, he is about to release a new film he also stars in. Clint is looking around for his next project. Jim Houston made his final and best film, The Dead, as a dying man on oxygen. The tank did not interfere with eye or ear. No finer cellist ever existed than Pablo Casals at the end of his days. Here is what the old may offer: a certain calm, fewer fulcations of the mind, less likelihood of going down rabbit holes, and ability to focus on the long view and things that really matter. Windowed learning, a true aim. The next opinion article reads, "The world's food supply has never been more vulnerable." After a cyber attack crippled the world's largest meat producer last week, JBS SA Meat plants have reopened across the globe, but the meat industry shouldn't be returning to business as usual. And for the security of our food supply, the Biden administration needs to make sure that it doesn't. The JBS subversion, which has been attributed to a Russia-linked cyber criminal group, was the latest in a series of black swan events that have crippled large-scale meat producers in recent years. The March 2019 fire in Holcomb, Kansas, destroyed a Tyson food plant that processed about 5% of U.S. beef. In April 2020, Major hog and chicken processing plants nationwide became COVID-19 hotspots, causing increased shutdowns that included the Tyson Fresh Meat plant in Waterloo. Last week's JBS attack sabotaged more than a fifth of all U.S. beef producing in a matter of minutes. It reminded us of a glaring truth that we already know. Consolidation has made the U.S. meat industry and the global protein supply profoundly and unacceptably vulnerable. It will become more susceptible in the years ahead as public health threats and potential cyber attacks continue to loom large, and as climate change increases the risk of natural disasters. In short, the cost-saving benefits of agricultural consolidation are increasingly outweighed by the risk of disproportion. Food industry experts have long been clamoring for systemic resilience. In April, as the pandemic bore down on meat producers and before he began his second tour as U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary, Tom Vilsack told me that we're better off having multiple plants in multiple locations, smaller facilities to produce enough product, and that may mean a little less profit, but it means that you have an incident like this that threatens your workforce, you'll have significant operation capacity. Vilsack recited this statement Tuesday in a call with reporters. Efficiency comes at a price, and that price is the lack of resilience when you have a major disruption. Yet, little has been done to centralize U.S. meat production. The Biden administration, along with state and federal lawmakers, have an urgent obligation not to just incentivize and support smaller and more diverse meat processors and producers, but also begin to dismantling and diversifying American meat monopolies, which have gone unchallenged and unchecked for too long. Sweeping reforms will take years, but the USDA can begin to mobilize a plan immediately. With the $4 billion allocated for food supply chain resiliency under the American Rescue Plan Act, Tuesday, Vilsack outlined how he intended to spend these funds, and while I applauded his plan to subsidize farmers practicing regenerative agriculture, inherently more resilient than industrial production, he should clarify his goals and timeline and at least triple the $60 million in grant money that has been earmarked to help expand smaller-scale meat and poultry processors across the country. Beyond grant money, smaller producers and processors need other forms of USDA support. Vilsack should continue reporting and refocusing the Food Safety and Inspection Service to better assist small and mid-sized players. He should create dedicated roles at the department to help local processors building regional markets while meeting the standards necessary to sell their products across the state lines and become competitive with large meat packers. Vilsack should also re-empower the Grain Inspection, Packers, and Stockyards Administration, hollowed out under President Donald Trump, to investigate large meat processors and hold them accountable. Vilsack's USDA should also be coordinating with the Department of Justice for more active enforcement and antitrust laws. Industrial Goliaths have accumulated a power grip on global agriculture. In the U.S. alone, four processing companies slaughter more than 80% of beef. Four meatpacking companies process roughly two-thirds of the nation's hogs, and five companies control about 60% of the boiler chicken market. The virtual integration of livestock and poultry supply chains with the same companies producing animals and slaughtering has stifled competition and led to watershed price fixing and corruption. The Biden administration and Congress must clarify and strengthen antitrust laws so that they more clearly apply to food production. And the president should continue to appoint people within the USDA and the DOJ who are willing to challenge the interests of industrial operations. a stance that's long been politically unfavorable for politicians on both parties. Not since Upton Sinclair's eye-opening novel, The Jungle, has the American meat industry faced a more significant paradigm shift, and Biden and Congress must get in front of it. If they don't, the U.S. and the world won't be able to maintain a reliable protein supply in an area defined by disruption. This opinion article was written by Amanda Little. Amanda Little is a professor of journalism and science writing at Vanderbilt University. She's the author of a Bloomberg opinion series on the fate of food after COVID-19, as well as the book, The Fate of Food, What We'll Eat in Bigger, Hotter, Smarter World. Why don't we take a dive into some sports news? The first sports story is a big story about Class 2A girls state soccer. The headline reads, Back to the Ship. Waverly Shell Rock girls have sights set on first state soccer title. This was filed by Jim Nelson of The Courier, Dateline, Des Moines. Three hard, when top-seeded Waverly Shell Rock hit an early speed bump Wednesday in the Class 2A girls state semifinal against Spencer, the Gohawks turned to a familiar mantra. Seeking a third straight trip to the championship game, WSR saw an early miscue give the Tigers a 1-2 lead midway through the first half. Instead of panicking, WSR turned the momentum quick to its side and scored the final 5 goals as the Gohawks trounced Spencer 5-1 on main pitch at the J.W. County Soccer Complex. One of our things is momentum, Gohawks star forward Kenzie Rawling said. It doesn't matter who scores it 3 hard minutes after, so I thought we responded well to them scoring, then us scoring and continuing the momentum. Waverly Shell Rock advances to a 12:30 p.m. title game against 7th seed Dallas Center Grimes, who blackened 3rd seed Norwalk 1-0 in the other semifinal. The Gohawks beat the Mustangs earlier this season 3-2. This is something we talked about all season and having that full confidence we are going to be there on Friday, Rawling said. We will rest up tomorrow and be ready Friday. Spencer got the first break of the game. The Tigers' Brooke Moser was the benefactor of the first WSR-only mistake on the first half. A long pass rolled into the WSR box, and freshman goalie Katie Agina came out to play it. Unfortunately, the ball spun out of Agina's hand right into Moser, who scored into an empty net at the 24th minute. But from that point on, it was all Gohawks. In the 27th minute, Rawling drew 3 defenders at the top of the box and slipped past Amanda Somberg, who buried her one-on-one chance with Spencer goalie Peyton Copper. I don't think we're nervous, WSR forward Anna Stromberg said. We had had our chances up until they got one lucky one, though. But once they got it, we knew we had to set up our game, find out and keep up our pace the rest of the game, and once we found our pace, we went with it, stuck with it, and we got goals. Agina came up big 2 minutes later, making a point-blank save on Tiger Landing scorer Alexa Johnson. In the 31st minute, Rawling hit the left post as WSR began to pepper Copper with a relentless attack. The Gohawks took the lead for good on great individual effort by Macy Smith. Smith made a run for the far left, turned the corner carrying the ball into the box, and her cross found Morgan Eichley for a 2-1 lead in the 37th minute. That's the fun part about our first 2 goals is they came from people who didn't get all the attention, Gohawk head coach Lauren Garner said. But I think that proves that we are 11 and something special about our team, their willingness across the board to be unselfish and set each other up, which is exactly what happened with the first and second goals. With then just minute and 5 seconds left to the half, Rawling trailed her 70th goal for the season after being up by Akeley and WSR and had 2-goal advantage at halftime. I think the first goal kind of lit a fire under us, and we just knew we needed to go out and finish our opportunities, Garner said. Rawling added her second goal in the 47th minute and completed her tactic in the 73rd minute with her 72nd goal of the season as the Gohawks dominated the final 40 minutes. We knew if we kept playing our game and settling in, connecting with our passes, we would be fine, Rawling said. We had all the confidence out there. The state championship berth is the Gohawks in 5th overall and 3rd straight. WSR is 0-4 in championship games. Obviously, we've made it there 2 times, and our goal is to finish it on Friday. We are not going to back down, Stromberg finished. The next sports story is a national story. The headline reads, Congress still hasn't come to NCAA's aid on NIL issue. This was filed by Ralph DeRusso of the Associated Press. A federal law governing how college athletes can earn money off their fame and celebrity seems certain to pass at some point. There is no real debate among lawmakers on Capitol Hill about whether athletes should be permitted to monetize their name, image, and likeness. There is broad consensus that Congress should pass a law that grants athletes NIL rights, Senator Roger Wicker, Republican, Massachusetts, said Wednesday during a hearing held by Senate Committee, Commerce Committee. But less than a month before NIL law goes into effect in several states, NCAA President Mark Emmett was back in Washington renewing his plea for help from Congress, help that is unlikely to come as soon as the NCAA would like. Some lawmakers, federal regulation of college sports should not end with NIL, and the time is right to tackle other issues, from long-term health care and educational opportunities for athletes to more uniform and enforced safety standards. To race to just an NIL bill and not addressing these injustices is tragic, Senator Cory Booker, Democrat, New Jersey, a former Stanford football player, said before Emmett and 5 other witnesses testified before the committee. Wicker wants to take a different approach, calling for a more feasible bill on a faster timeline. Emmett said the NCAA plans to act on its proposed NIL legislation soon, preferably by the end of the month, Emmett said. The Division I Council meets June 22nd through the 23rd and could take action then, but only a federal law can permit the state's laws in Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, and New Mexico that are set to go into effect July 1st. Earlier Wednesday, Connecticut became the 19th state to pass NIL legislation. Senator Rich Blumenthal, Democrat, Connecticut, who has sponsored the bill with Booker, the sweeping college athlete bill of rights, said he would block any federal NIL bill that is less permissive than Connecticut's. We need to listen to the athletes, Blumenthal said. They are the ones who are all too frequently numbered in this conversation. There were no athletes among the witnesses who testified at the 5th NIL-related hearing in Congress over the past year. But Chairman Senator Maria Cantwell, Democrat, Washington, said there was a plan to hear from a panel of athletes in the future. College sports leaders have warned a patchwork of state laws will make it impossible for schools to compete against each other to do so on a level playing field. The impact would be enormous, Gonzaga men's basketball coach Mark Fuel told the committee. You'd be at a huge competitive disadvantage, both with students and student athletes are coming out of high school and when they have the opportunity to transfer. The NCAA's NIL proposal would place so-called guardrails around deals athletes could make to protect against third-party payments being used as recruiting and endorsements or pay-for-play. Most of the state laws have been passed also place some limitations on the types of NIL deals athletes can do. ESPN college football analyst and former Stanford football player Rod Gilmore, who also holds a law degree, said guardrails benefit the NCAA more than the athletes. Players have been treated like second-class citizens, he said. Senator Ben Ray, Lujan, Democrat, New Mexico, ended the hearing by asking each panelist if they thought college athletes should be able to profit from their names, images, and likenesses. After each answered yes, Lujan asked, "So why is this taking so long?" And that wraps up today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, June 10th. I'm your reader, Maddie Ryan. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. And as always, thank you so much for listening.